Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artists First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning into the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. This show airs every Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about the show and listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/MaxineThompson.htm. And don't forget to follow Artist First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle @artist_first. And now here's your host of the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show, Dr. Maxine Thompson.
Good evening. Welcome to the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show of MaxineThompson.com and MaxineThompsonBooks.com. Happy New Year. I've taken a 7-week hiatus, and it's good to be back. I just finished writing L.A. Blues 2, which is due out 5/29/12. But with no further ado, I want to introduce tonight's guest. Her name is Suzetta Perkins. She's a national best-selling author of 7 titles. Her latest title is Betrayed. Good evening, Suzetta.
Good evening, Maxine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you on the show. You've just been such a consistent person. You know, a lot of people are impatient in this business, but I've seen you just have the patience of Job. It took 2 years for me to get you a book deal, and you've turned out 1 book every year through Simon & Schuster since. You've been on Black Expressions. You've been a best-selling author. And you work a full-time job, so you need to tell the audience about yourself.
Wow. Well, you know, yes, I do. I work a 9-to-5, 9-to-6 job. Actually, I work for a university, secretary of the university. It's a strenuous job, but when I come home at night, I turn that computer on and I get to writing, because writing really is my passion. I mean, I just love creating stories, you know, and I have these colorful characters that come to me all through the day telling me what I need to write, this, that, and the other, and, you know, it just, you know, now that I've actually, you know, been writing for a while, you know, it almost comes naturally, you know, the stories just unfold for me, but something I hope, you know, I can do just by my, you know, just write without having any other things in the way. But I really enjoy it. It is my passion, as I say it.
Yes, and what I like about you, Suzette, is that you travel and you push your books. A lot of writers I've got book deals for, they don't go anywhere. They don't do anything. Then they wonder why the books aren't selling, and it's hard for me to fight for them if I don't see where they've been pushing their books. Now, when I see where your book is out there and you're here, there, and winning awards, then I got a leg to stand on. But it's very difficult to challenge statements when there is no one going anyplace. Weren't you at the Baltimore Festival and no other writer showed up but you and one other in the same?
Yes, for our particular line, yes, that's true. But I think it's so important to connect with the readers. I enjoy meeting, you know, readers, and I enjoy hearing them tell me that they love the book. You know, a lot of times when I converse with them, you know, they're talking to me about my characters, you know, and as if they were real people, you know, and I just really enjoy that. I meet, you know, and I try to, you know, go two different places, meaning outside of my locale every year, you know, someplace different. Last year I went to Chicago, I went to D.C., Baltimore. And I did go to some other places as well, you know, but I try to, because that's the only way that people will get to know you. And I think when people hear what you have to say, when you talk passionately about your work, you know, people, you know, tend to gravitate towards you, you know, especially if you've written something well that they enjoy. And then they tell others about it. But I also have gotten, you know, in the age of technology, I have really been, you know, very vocal on Facebook, and my Twitter is getting there, but I'm doing that as well.
Yes. Well, let's talk about the latest title Betrayed, I read it in an afternoon. And, you know, I had seen bits and pieces of your manuscript, but when the book came, and actually I had one of the pre-pub books, I sat down and read in the afternoon. And when that happens, and, you know, I had a lot going on, I said, this is a good book. And, I mean, it's been borne out. I think people are loving this one. But talk about it. Give us a brief synopsis.
Okay. Well, Betrayed is about Mimi Bailey. She's my main character, and she's carrying a 19-year-old secret, a secret that she intends to take to the grave with her. And that secret, and what happened is when she was a freshman in college, she was raped by her best friend's fiancé. She never reported the rape, and she never told her best friend for fear that, you know, the best friend might not believe her. So she kind of vanished and went away, and now here it is. Well, her 18-year-old daughter is ready to go to college, and how about this? She wants to go to the college that her mother went to and was raped. And her mother does everything she can to dissuade her from going. However, her daughter, who is named Africa, she wins out. And so mother picks up and follows Africa to Durham, North Carolina, the scene of the particular story. And I actually have it at a college. I work for a university, so it takes place at a university, North Carolina Central. You happen to use that as a backdrop. And so what happens is that, you know, Mimi, you know, she prays that her past won't catch up with her. But unbeknownst to her, the perpetrator is working on that particular campus. And he does find out that Mimi is in town. And so the story is about Mimi, all the lengths that Mimi goes through to protect her family from this secret. And what, you know, and it just is amazing what one will do, you know, when they're put to the test. And so I found it very interesting. I mean, honestly, there's so many twists and turns in this book, and sometimes I even wonder how I came up with some of the stuff, you know, that I wrote about, you know. But I always, I'm a current events type of person, and as I said, I work at a university, and I've worked in, you know, our legal department. And so, you know, I've seen a lot of things, and I know a lot of things, and not that I utilize anything that was current on my campus, you know, but I know that, you know, women have gone through these things, you know. And so I wanted to talk about that, you know. But, of course, I wanted to make it this, you know, thrilling story, you know, that, you know, people wouldn't forget. And it's amazing because, really, I never thought of this story as being one of my best stories, but I have just been getting so much wonderful feedback. And, I mean, people every day are telling me, this is your best story.
I think it is your best. I mean, I beg to differ. You know why I think it's your best? Because you're dealing with a topical issue, rape. That is one of the most deadliest crimes, that and incest, and it's a hidden crime.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, if you get murdered, you get cut, well, then people can see that. But rape is a crime that is a crime of the soul.
Yeah.
And it's one on the continuum of violence, like most rapists. Mm-hmm. They see that as a way of controlling a person. And women are most of the victims. I mean, you know, they say men get raped. Well, definitely men in prison a lot. But men are the biggest perpetrators, so women are the biggest victims when it comes to rape, if you look at the stats. And I think that's, so you hit a hot button right there. That's
I've had people, you know, to write me just even as of this week to say, you know, thank you for writing that. You know, you don't know how close you came to, you know, to what has happened to me, you know. You don't know, you know, and you know, I just appreciate you sharing, you know. You just don't know. And, you know, and that's how, and I always like to try to, you know, have a good resolve. And sometimes my resolves aren't good, you know. But, you know, I hope that when a reader reads my book, that if they do see themselves in a person, you know, a character that I have, you know, whether they be good or bad, you know, that, you know, there's going to be some resolve for them, you know. And so, anyway, I really enjoy
healing, not just resolve, healing. I think that's
healing,
the word.
Yeah,
underneath,
uh-huh.
I try to look for how can people heal. And
you
know, if you're anywhere over 40, you should have enough life experience where you can kind of see I mean, it's just a lot of biblical principles that go through life. And a lot of, when you're young, when I read the younger books, there's no consequences. You know, people who tend to write in their 20s. No, but when you live long enough, you see. You
right.
What you sow, you see all these little different things, because that came through in your book. No one walked away clean. No one walked away without consequences for their bad choices. And
right.
The mother, and you know, how many women have carried children that they were the product of rape? And
yeah.
Then I like that you had the Project Twins. They took that off of Amazon when I put that
down.
I never heard of Project Twins until I listened to the game with on the night, too. But, and so do you know what the Project Twins is?
No, I'm laughing, but I don't.
Okay, this is an urban saying. When two women are pregnant at the same time by one man.
Oh.
And that's why I said your story was probably, I mean, these two girls meet in college, and these type
right.
of street accidents happen all the time.
Yes.
Like, I see people all the time who look like my family. Once I was on a plane going to a family reunion. It turned out that the lady I kept looking at, we got to the reunion.
And she was there?
There. And she was, and turned out they lived in L.A. This was about 10 years ago. So in this case where these two girls met, I've known of people where this happened, too.
Mm.
And here they're 19 or 18, however, and they meet and find out. And so I don't want to give away no more of the story, but I like that Project Twin twist you had.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
It happens, which is unfortunate, you know.
Yeah.
And, but it does, you know, and...
yeah, men having two families, you go to the
yeah.
funeral, there's a whole other family, and that has been going on since the beginning of the time.
Right, yeah. And for Mimi, I think that, you know, because one of the questions that book clubs have, you know, have asked me, you know, well, why didn't she share that, you know? Why didn't she tell anybody? You know, why didn't she tell Brenda? And, you know, they were young at that time, and, you know, this was her best friend, and...
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those what if, you know, we don't know what Brenda would have done, you know, if she had learned it. She may have believed her, but then I give you a little flavor of that when, you know, without saying a whole lot, you know, when Brenda does find out, you know, I mean, you know, she doesn't know, you know, I mean, she probably wants to believe it, but at first, you know, she's not, you know, grasping it at first, you know, I mean, it's just so... unthinkable, you know, in her mind, you know, especially since Mimi hadn't told her a long time ago, you know. And so you just don't know
how. She was married to the guy, right? She ended up marrying
the person. Ended up marrying him, yes. Uh-huh, right.
And he was some piece of slime. I don't even want to talk about
it. I know. I wrote him up good. I wrote him up good. But, you know, there are different people, and it wasn't just one person who was betrayed in that story. There was a lot of people that were not without, you know, telling all the whole story because it's such a, you know, web that I wove, you know. But there are a lot of people in that story who were betrayed, you know. And, you know, just it's like one of those things. Like if you know, my parents say, okay, if you tell a lie, then you got to tell another lie, to cover the other lie, you know, and then you forget who you done told this one to, you know, and you you get all tangled up, you know, trying to protect this, that, and the other, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you got this whole network out here that you got to try to protect, you know, and that's kind of what has happened, you know, because. Of the other people who are involved, you know, Mimi's husband, you know, I won't go there. I won't tell that part of the story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
we're in trying to hide that secret. Secrets almost, I said that in Hostage of Lies. Which, the secrets almost become as powerful as a ghost, you know.
They're
to haunt you. You never know. Oh, Lord, who knows?
You said that more simplistically than I did, but that's what I mean.
Yeah, I'm trying to hide that secret. Who knows? Looking over his shoulder, and he had a big one there, too, and he did everything almost close to murder trying to hide it, too.
Right. And, you know, the sad thing is that, you know, a lot of times, I mean, even if, let's say, a person can carry to the grave, half the time, you know, the secret, if you tell one person, you know, it's airborne, you know, and those secrets, you know, I've seen secrets long after a person's gone come out, you know, and how it destroys people, how it destroys families, you know, and so forth. So, Yeah, that was a tough one. That was a tough one.
Yes, and it's what you call a moral ambiguity or a moral quagmire. You just it makes the readers think, what would I do if I were in her shoes or his shoes?
Right.
Do you have the book with you where you might read a short excerpt for about 3 minutes? I don't have.
Yes, I have. Yeah, what I was going to do. I'm glad I looked at that before. Before you called, I was just going to read one of her journal entries that she had, and this is after Victor, who is the perpetrator in this story, has found out that she exists and that she's living back in Durham, that Mimi is living back in Durham, and he has been to her house, and so Mimi writes about this. A one in a million chance. Were the odds of me running into Victor or Brenda. I would have never won the lottery with those odds. But somehow, fate has a way of making a believer out of me. Who would have thought my worst nightmare, which had been temporarily parked in the furthermost recess of my mind, would descend upon me out of nowhere in the middle of the day when I was minding my own business, oblivious to what the neighbors on either side of me were doing, let alone old friendships that had died hard. Maybe it was my paranoia, or maybe I spoke this madness into existence. But now I've got a fight on my hands, one that has put a fight within me that I didn't know existed. Victor had the audacity to show up on my doorstep today, get in my face, and demand to know if he was Africa's father. Who in the hell does he think he is? And when he received confirmation from me that Africa is his child, he had the nerve to tell me that Africa and I had to leave Durham so that his reputation would be intact. I'm neither his wife or his concubine. I should have busted his tail a long time ago and explained to Brenda later, but she probably wouldn't have believed me if I told her that her sorry-ass fiancé had raped me. Brenda wants to meet me, but I can't. Too many years have passed to try and rekindle a relationship that I still want. I thought about Brenda often, wondering whether she married Victor, if she had kids, and what she looked like. Would she have that same award-winning smile that used to melt men's hearts? Something keeps tugging at me on the inside, telling me to tell Africa, to tell Brenda before things get out of hand, because no amount of talking will repair the damages my silence have rendered. Lord, I need your direction. I need you to show me what I'm to do. I'm prepared to fight Victor, but I need to know the how. Africa is my primary concern, and I'll let no one hurt her except over my dead body. She's my baby, my only baby, Mimi Bailey. And so that's kind of the heart of it.
She had married someone else, right?
Who's that? Mimi?
Mimi, yes.
Yes, she married Raphael.
And does Raphael think that Africa is his child?
Yeah, but, you know, he may have, you know, I believe that he thinks that she is, you know, even though he may have, you know, you know, he may have had some, you know, thought about it, you know, but I think for the most part he believed she was, you know.
Okay, that's why it's been a while since I read it.
Yeah.
Oh, what a mess. And now you got your new book that's going to be a mess, too. So, well, let's go back over some of your other books that you've written.
Oh, okay, well.
Yeah, just kind of write down your titles.
Okay, my first novel that was released in 2006, was Behind the Veil. I followed that up with its sequel, which is Deja Vu, and hopefully sometime in the near future, the third in that series will come out, which is entitled In My Rearview Mirror. And I'm just really excited about this particular book because Behind the Veil, which was my very first novel, is still a very popular book, you know, in my suitcase there. And then I have a standalone, which is called A Love So Deep. I call that my mature adult love story. And I think that you had coined that phrase, and I think I've been saying it ever since.
Yes, I like that. You know,
yes,
love isn't just only for the young. We need more love the older
right,
we get.
Right,
I love that
right.
story.
And I like that story because it's not your typical love story, you know, romance novel. You know, your girl meets boy, girl and boy falls in love, and girl and boy falls out of love, and girl and boy gets back together. This is I think it's an in-depth look at love, you know. And again, as typical of me, you know, it has a lot of twists and turns, you know, in this particular story. Because this is a story about the man who loses his wife. He's a little older. He loses his wife and finds himself at the bottom of loneliness. But he does find new love. But his daughters, in the form of a younger woman, and his grown daughters are just not having it. So is that I had fun with that, you know, showing all the folks that were, you know, kind of chasing him and so forth, you know, but. You know, the love that he found was really a true love, you know. And then my Exterminator series, I love all of my books. I love them, you know, all. I have no one book that I like more than the other. But Exterminator, that was my third book that I wrote. And it's also a series, and was followed up by Nothing Stays the Same. And in May, the third in that series, At the End of the Day, will come out, and that's gonna be good too. That's really good and juicy. There's five couples. In fact, that book started off with four or five friends who were divorced, and you know they found themselves on this emotional roller coaster, and they formed a support group, but the support group needed a support group because they had a lot of issues, a lot of drama going on, you know.
And there were men and women, I like
Yeah,
that.
There were men and women, right, exactly, you know. And, but anyway, they, it's, you know, in the end, they all helped each other to get over. And then the second book that followed up, most of the couples, most of the characters in there got married, either to someone in the group or someone else. And so, of course, you know, drama continues, you know, so I always like to stir the pot and cause a little mayhem, you know, and so that one, I wrote that during the time that Obama was running for president, and so you saw a lot of the recession because the main character, Marvin, in that particular story, he was about to lose his business, and he was about to lose his business. He had gone, he had made some bad deals, and then he was threatened with a takeover, and another incident caused him to the target of an extortion attempt. But anyway, I don't want to give all the story away, but anyway, it was...
Now, that's Nothing Stays the Same, right?
That was Nothing Stays the Same.
After they got married and...
Yes, right.
The divorce
group,
they had
right.
remarried different ones.
Right, uh-huh.
Then everything was beautiful, and then the recession hit. And I'm loving these books that are hitting the recession up, because most enduring American stories come from... the depression, like Grapes of Wrath,
uh-huh.
Gone with the Wind, even though that was, you know, capturing the Civil War, but Grapes of Wrath, that captures, and, you know, Imitation of Life was also written during the depression.
Mm-hmm. And it shows it from different perspectives, you know. I mean, you know, we see, you know, we hear in the news or see in the news all the other folks that, you know, have gone through, you know, but these are, you know, corporate America, black folks that, you know, have... been...
Well, they had the American dream in their
hands. Exactly. You know, and I mean, these weren't, you know, the $24,000 a year folks, you know, with jobs. You know, they had nice homes and all of that, you know, CEOs of their own corporations, you know. But anyway, Nothing Stays the Same. And, you know, the friends, they rally around each other and to help this couple, you know, overcome, you know, all the things that they were going through. And I like it because it ended on the day that Obama was elected president. In fact, I'm in a writer's group, and one of the exercises that we had, one of the guys had given us was okay, write in our writers group, write the, you know, what you were doing the day that Obama was elected president. And I remember that, you know, so I, you know, even though it's a different story, I imported that into my story, you know, and so I really liked it because it offered hope, you know. We were talking about, you know, Obama was, you know, offering hope, you know, a change and so forth. So I really liked the way that book ended, even though one of the mad crazy ladies did, that was in the story that caused some havoc, did break out of jail. And it's funny, my father, my father, who was 86 years old, he said, what are you writing now? He said, did they ever catch that Peaches woman? You know, he liked Peaches. I said, yes. I said, why do you like Peaches, you know? But he liked Peaches, so
listen,
I told him.
You know what? Mentioning your father, I like when I heard you at, was that the Borders bookstore when you came out here and I went to your book signing with you in California?
Yes,
Borders bookstore before they closed.
Yes.
And you were telling the kind of the origins of the different stories, and I appreciated that. I see a lot of writers say, oh, it's just all my imagination. I can be walking down the street and hear some words, like I heard someone at the hotel say the dog and pony show since I've been sequestered here. And that ended up in my story. So I don't ever say, oh, it just come out from my imagination. Some is imagination, but some are words or conversations over here. You said that your father, when your mother died after long marriage, your father was so depressed, so you wrote, this is like the alternative story that he had married someone. So, you know, I appreciated how you admitted that you took little things, a little bit from your life and then spent it all. Well, you still have that emotion. That's why I believe your characters sound so real. My L.A. Blues is a fictional character, but had I not been a social worker for 23 years, I wouldn't have known. I'm just old enough now to step back and step inside. What do these kids go through? You know, all these facts used to come at me, okay, mother's in jail, blah, blah. I never thought about how does it shape a person's psyche, you know.
Right. I mean, if I can digress and talk about you, because I've read L.A. Blues, a wonderful book, but I could feel the emotions. As I read your book, I felt the emotions that your character was going through, you know, your main character. I felt it. The other girls that were in there, you know, because of their situation and because of their plight, I felt it because you wrote it in such a way, you know. I mean, I was gritting my teeth and, you know, holding out hope, you know, that the little boy wasn't going to be hurt or he wasn't going to get killed, you know. So I think it's just so important, you know, that, you know, when you can write passionately, you know, when you can put that element in it, that three-dimensional portion of it, you know, it just does something for the story. And I think that people tend to gravitate, you know, towards it because they can feel, you know. I think one of the things I learned in my writers group was that, you know, you have to be able to, the reader has to be able to, you know, you have to write with the five senses, you know, touch, taste, feel. And so, you know.
You have to have lived. Now, in your case, Suzette, I'm looking over your webpage. You have lived in how many countries is this in?
I have been to over 20-something countries.
I know you've traveled a lot since I've known you as your agent, and then you say you've traveled a lot. And then weren't you originally from California, but now you're in North Carolina?
Yes, Yes, my home is California. In fact, my family is still there where I grew up.
Okay. So, I mean, all that life, when you've lived, you can go to writing classes and you can sit in a university. But if you haven't been out there and lived, and that living even comes out in your writing, and that's what I think it is all your life experience comes through your writing. You can see that you've experienced things, and you give your stories great backdrops. You give them great settings. A lot of new writers are very weak on setting, and I used to be very weak on it. I try to work with it more now. But setting, it can be its own character, and I love how you describe so much in the house. I love it.
Well, yeah, and I think that's really one of my gifts, you know, the description, you know. But because I know that for me, I like to be able to feel it. I like to be able to see it, you know. And I have to credit a lot of it to my writers group again, you know. I learned so much, you know, so much in my writers group. I don't you know, I haven't participated in a while, but it was just so valuable to me because I learned so much. You know, a lot of times we write books and we write and we read them over again, but sometimes we can't see it until someone shows us, you know, or tells us, you know, okay, they can, you know, I remember in, was it A Love So Deep? Even with Behind the Veil, people say, I can touch, I was in the club, I was in the this, and I could feel this, and I was eating, I was sitting at, you know, and I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah, writers groups are good, so that's a good recommendation. I've been in one since 92, and I would say it has really helped my writing, too. Sometimes writers think they can write in a vacuum, and I've seen pros and cons on the Internet. Some are for writers groups, some are against it because they feel that it stifles them. But I think writers groups have been good for me, listening to other writers and sharpening your iron sharpens iron, sharpening your brain on other creative people's brain,
right.
And then they critique your work and you critique theirs, and you come out somewhere in between with a much better story. So that I'm so glad that you've been in a writer's group. How long have you been in one, Suzetta?
It's a number of years. Probably about 8 years.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That really helped. And you had your book edited when you...
I had not even published my very first book, Behind the Veil. I had written it, and it was still, I had it professionally edited twice, you know, even before I, you know, sent it out, to try to get it published. But... during that process, I think I had gone to my first writer's group, and I learned something about the point of view, and that was something that was really disturbing for me because I really didn't understand it. I tried to understand it, but I didn't. But it was one particular session that we had, and we were reading, you know, each person was taking a turn reading, you know, a section of their story. And then people were pointing it out, and that was the moment I finally got it. And I remember going through Behind the Veil one more time. I said, I got to, as much as I had edited this, re-edited, and re-edited it again, I finally got it. And I said, oh, my goodness, you know, so I had to go through it again, you know, to, you know, try to make certain, you know, even though I know I had to do some rewriting, but... I accredit that writer's group for helping me to really understand what that point of view is. Because I've read a lot of other people's books that, you know, a lot of the self-published. And, I mean, that head hopping, I don't know who's talking, whose thought it is, you know, and so forth. And I said, gosh, I wish they had the same experience that I had so they would know, you know, what it sounds like when someone's reading their work and, you know, they become miscombobulated, you know, because they don't know who's talking, who's thinking this, and so forth, you know. So, I credit that writer's group for that.
Point of view is very important. Now, I'm going to do my little teaching part. Now, I teach a lot of writing classes. Point of view is your guide. You have to think of a story as a journey, and the person who's guiding. And what I tell writers is try to, now with first person, it's a lot easier. And if you have all your multiple point of view characters in first person, no problem. But when you have point of view characters that are third person, you should give each person their own scene. Who has the most to lose in that scene?
Mm-hmm.
Always look at what is at stake. Mm-hmm. What are they going to, like in your book, Victor was afraid of losing his marriage, his public front, his public facade, that people find out he was a rapist. So he had a lot to lose, and that's what you look at. But you can do that with point of view, but when you're head hopping, so just because it's good to self-publish now, and that is open season, I understand, for USA Today, 15 self-published writers were chosen as best books of the year, you still should learn the craft of writing. It's an ongoing thing. A writer who recently I edited, she said, oh, I'm so glad it came to you. I said, well, I study, and she said, and I'll continue, because see, some... If what she was saying, if you keep up the good work, I say, well, I keep studying the craft. I'm constantly listening to teleseminars. I have all types of books I'm writing. Mm-hmm. A lot of writers don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they just want to just throw some stories together, and they're not really trying to get better. Each book should top the last. I've seen just a progression in all your books. That each one has gotten better than the last. But let's see if we have any emails. Do we have any emails?
Yeah, we have. Well, actually, it's a comment from Diana in Akron, Ohio. Okay. It says, Maxine, it's good to hear you back live. We missed you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that, Diana.
Yes.
It's good to be back.
All right. Well, if there's any there's any more, I'll let you know, okay?
Okay. So anyone who wants to email in and ask Suzetta any questions is dj@artistfirst.com that they can email in. But I'm enjoying this. It's like a riff when I'm talking to you. It's like jazz because we're two writers and we're just... Go ahead, and I'm sorry if I've been interrupting you, but you know,
that's okay.
Getting all
that's
fired
okay.
up. Listen, I can talk about books all day.
I know. That is quite all right. I wanted to also say that, you know, I have an extensive library. You know, that was one of the things out of I did it prior to even getting into that writer's group, but the person who facilitated it, often, you know, recommended books, you know, that would help us, you know, and a lot of it, dialogue, the beginning, middle, and end, settings and so forth. So I have a lot of those books that really were very, very helpful, you know. I mean, even though, you know, I may have set a scene for myself, but I went back to really understand how to do that, you know. So, arming yourself with books that and read them, you know, with that will help you to become a good writer, because I'm really about the craft as well. You know, I enjoy writing, but I do want to tell a good story, you know, when I am writing, you know. So I'm very concerned about the craft, you know. I want to be a good writer, you know, not just someone who wrote a book, but I want to be a good writer. That is, you know, one of my main objectives, you know, to be a good writer and to be known for being a good writer, as well as telling a good story.
Well, I'm going to make some recommendations, and then I'm going to ask you some recommendations of books that have helped you as a writer. The first one I'm going to recommend is Donald Moss. He's a literary agent out of New York, kind of big name. In his book, The Breakout Novelist, and also his workbook, The Breakout Novelist, I used that one about 7 years ago, 6 years ago, and it helped me become a better editor, too, because he examined all the books that made the New York Times during hard times, and he was finding out the breakout novelists were, a lot of them were first-time novelists.
Right.
So he was trying to say what happened, because a lot of the mid-list authors were being canceled, contracts canceled. So he said, well, what did these people do? So he studied different things that all of their books had in common, and I learned that as an editor, and it has helped me with books. And so remember that one. And then the other one is Writing Fiction. I just got that one. You can get a lot of them off of Writer's Digest, James Scott Bell. And my little hush-hush Secrets of Writing Fiction essay is not too bad either. It's an e-book.
Yeah. Oh, so you did the book. Okay.
Yes, I wrote it in 2000, but I might, I've got a new one I want to write. Now I got some more insights. But how about you, Suzetta? What are some of the books that you would recommend to the listeners?
Well, the first five pages, I don't have my book in me right here with the author's name. And I just gave that to a... making to an author not too long ago.
Yeah, he's an agent too. I have that one at my house.
Yeah, because I think it's just so important. You know, I mean, you'll hear most writers say, or readers rather, say that, you know, if I can't catch the book in the first five pages or the first page or first three pages, you know, then I'm gonna put the book down. So it's so important to, you know, hit that reader, you know, in the very beginning. So that's a very good book. Since I'm a writer of fiction, you know, I have several. I can't even think of the names of them now. Goodness gracious, I'm on the spot. Can't even think of the names now of the books. But it's about writing fiction, you know.
Yeah, and Saul Stein on writing. He's got a couple of books on novel.
Yes, he is definitely one of my authors, yes.
Right, and he used to edit, and he was a publisher and an author, but he also edited James Baldwin. One of the first ones that, you know, learned the rhythm of black speech and Ebonics and so forth. And, I mean, there's just so many good books out there, the Mastering the Novel, and let me see, I'm putting in the first five pages so that you can, Noah Lukman, that's his name, the author of the first five pages.
Oh, okay,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I
think
of. How
to stay out of the rejection pile. And see, that's not only for the reader. This is to get, if you want to get a book deal, The Plot Thickens, I have that one.
Oh, that's
Noah Lukman, Eight Ways to Bring Fiction to Life.
Oh, that's a good one. You can send those to me on email.
Yeah.
By email.
Yeah, so there. So, and here's another one. I just saw the first 50 pages. Engage agents, editors, and readers to set your novel up for success. It does. I always, even when I'm an editor, I'll even tell them if their first line is too bland. I just open what. I'm on his fourth book, and everyone knows him, Mondale Pope.
Oh, yeah.
The one that came out like gangbusters, and he must have requested me again, so I'm glad of that.
Oh, Mondale, I know Mondale.
Blew me out the water. I just looked at his first line, I just put it down, I say no more. So he's a great student. It's just like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know Mondale.
Oh, you do? Okay. Yeah, so his writing has grown so much, and I'm so proud of him. He has really grown.
Yeah, and like, and as I was saying earlier, there's a series, and I don't the name of the author escapes me, but it's The Beginning, Middle, and the End is one. Let's see, what is it? The Things.
I remember I've had some books that are just for dialogue.
Yeah,
good. Sometimes you'll just get a book that covers one thing, setting.
Yeah, and that's how it is. It's broken up like that.
Good, because, I mean, you have to know how to use. I always think of books in three acts, and act one is generally the decision. Actually, the decision to murder, the decision to kidnap, the decision to have a threesome. That was in Carl Weber's book. I broke it down like that. And I think that was his one something on the side, the decision to have a threesome. I say, then there's the action. And that's act two. And that's when the stuff happened. And then act three is generally the consequences of it. You know, the fallout, everything go to, you know, think of Shakespeare, how everybody's man on the stage. At the end of the play.
Right.
So that's how you can't always think of what was the decision, you know, and generally, and then something should happen. Some departure from the norm should happen. And it should be, and I always use the hero's journey, too. The person's life is on notice to change. All the great, they say all the major blockbusters and even the books use the hero's journey. And we've been telling that story over and over from the beginning of time. So you go on Google and look up the hero's journey. And then I also get an email from a place in England about the hero's journey where they break down different movies or books and tell you which sections it could be. And generally like bridges, that's when they're traveling into a different when they're beginning to cross over into the out of their ordinary world. They leave the heroes leaving this ordinary world, but Godfather, Titanic, let me see what other ones they'd like to refer to. Star Wars. I mean, these are movies that were blockbusters that made mega bucks. They all, if you look at them, they break it down. Pulp Fiction is even broken down because there's a book for the hero's journey too. One is Joseph Conrad, who wrote the original one, but then there's one that Hollywood uses. I can't think of his name.
Maxine, we have another email.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. This is from an aspiring author, John Capp. He says, how can you tell when you have a story in your head if anyone will want to read it or find it interesting if you write it?
Wow.
Go ahead, Suzetta. I'll let you answer first, then I'll go after you. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I think that if you love the idea, and you sit down and you come, I mean you can actually write about it. I think that that's number one. You know, for me, when I have an idea in my head, if there is a story to be told, it just seems to come to me, and I start writing notes about it, and I enjoy, and I'm really excited about what I'm writing, then I feel in my heart, you know, that this might be a story that people would like, that would, you know, that people would, you know, possibly like. You know, of course, you don't really know until you finish the whole book. But for me, generally, if I have an idea that I think that people, especially because, as I said earlier, I do a lot of current events, things that people would gravitate towards, that people, that you know that other people would possibly pay attention to, I think that's, you know, first base for me. How about you, Maxine?
Yes, I always say you have the idea. You start with a lot of notes, ideas that you get from TV, ideas. Keep files of ideas interesting. I have a file. One of them was different murders that happened in the news, and I would say, "What if that don't even sound right? How did he come home and find his whole family murdered? It just doesn't seem right, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So different things that click in your gut. Because I'm beginning to write crime fiction now. And then you also, you keep an idea file. And from there, you go with your passion. Write about what you're passionate about, because there'll be other people passionate about it. Pay attention. You can watch CNN, read newspapers, be a wide, avid reader. Read a lot so you can, and read, you know, bestsellers, so you can see what did this author do with his writing to learn how to tell the story. So, but you start with the idea, so start keeping an idea file. And from there, you can maybe an idea over here that's totally unrelated. Like this girl came to my computer class in 2002 with a ferret. And that, and she showed it to me, and that ferret worried me to death. He's part cat, part rat, and part dog. And she brought him in the cage, and he ended up in my book, L.A. Blues, as Ben, which is the name of my pit bulldog that I have at home. And Ben was a rat and also a movie. So, you know, you take a lot of these ideas will congeal and get together in your subconscious, and it will start having a pattern and an order, which can become a story.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how you start with ideas.
Yeah.
And just, but you have to write it down. Just write a lot of notes and then start with your first chapter. But study the craft and learn how to set it up. And like I say, the hero's journey helped me a lot with L.A. Blues, too, so that I didn't have to write all over the place and then have to move out stuff. I stay close to the things that your hero has to go through when they're crossing over, and that I used the imagery of hell, that she was descending into hell, and I even, the subtitle was Slipping in the Darkness. So, you know, and then pay attention to the myths. Read great myths. There's nothing new under the sun. Read the Bible, get stories from there. Read the myths, like Helen of Troy, that's a myth I use in L.A. Blues, too. So, but there's just so many things for writers.
There are, I mean, you know, and it's funny, you know, she used to say that, because I also do that, you know. I write lots of notes, and I even have folders, you know, you know, on my computer that for future stories that I might write, you know. And I love my, you know, my iPad, you know, because I mean, I have, you know, when ideas come to me, I'm just jotting them down. But what I was initially going to say was, I was in church Sunday, and, you know, I was writing, you know, the what the minister was saying. I said, oh, my goodness, this is going to be good, you know. And I sometimes do sermons and so forth, you know, but they may become the topic of, you know, of one of my books, you know. So just everyday living, you know, watching TV, you know, maybe a phrase that, you know, someone's passing by, or, you know, people come to me with phrases too. I have a friend I call, in fact, I acknowledge her in my book that's coming up. I call her my phraseologist, you know, because they always come to me because they know that they said, don't talk around Susetta because you know she's going to tell.
That's what people say about me. One friend, my sister-in-law, she cracked me up once. She said, you better not use Angron's name in your book. I know, because I love names now. I love black names. Oh, my goodness. Our names are so expressive and metaphorical and almost describe people, like whack. I mean, we have names that are just, especially since I'm writing about gang members now. I try to make sure there's no known gang member. I try to switch it up.
Right, right.
But it we have beautiful names. And
yes, and you know what?
So many things.
Yes, and I have to share this story. I'm so glad you brought that up. Wow. Speaking of names, I'm always writing down names. When I go, and that's another thing, when I go to a bookstore, you know, when I go to a book signing or wherever it is, and, you know, I have a book that I ask people to, you know, put their name in and email so I can, you know, contact them and let them know about future projects that I'm working on, et cetera. But, you know, I always compliment people on names, you know, and I say, oh, I really like your name. I might use it in the book. In fact, a lot of my names are names that I have gotten from other people. But I say, haven't said all of that, and I know I got to hurry. When I wrote Betrayed, the two names in here are Brenda and Citrina. Citrina is Mimi. And I remember this one lady I had met several years ago at an AKA event. Her name was Citrina, and she had purchased my first book, Behind the Veil, and she was just so excited, and she said, girl, you can use my name, and da-da-da-da. She gave me her whole bio, you know, yo-yo-yo. So anyway, when I wrote this, I said, you know what? I like Citrina, you know, and I'm
going to use that name, too, Citrina.
Uh-huh. And so anyway, and Brenda, it's just a common name. I just kind of really pulled it out the hat, you know, on, you know, because, you know, it happened, you know, thinking of the time that, you know, that this happened. So 20 years ago, okay, so Brenda, you know. So I used that name. Well, how about I was at a book signing in Durham, and these three people walk in. This has just happened in November. And they were pointing at me, and they were laughing, and I'm like, who are these people, you know? And they said, don't you remember us? And I'm like, you look kind of familiar, you know. I didn't want to say no. And they said, girl says, well, gosh, you captured me well in your book, you know. Well, her name was Brenda. But, you know, I didn't write it. I didn't put that, use that name because of this person. But this is the kicker. The other girl says, well, my name is all over this book. And I said, you're Citrina. She says, yes, I am her. And the other girl, Brenda, said, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I do things along that line, and there was something else in there. She didn't share it with me. She says that I must have looked through the window of her soul and captured it. Well, their best, Citrina and Brenda, these real people, they're best friends. And how about, in my book, the two best friends were named Citrina and Brenda? And I'm like, oh, my goodness. It was unreal. Well, of course, they brought people to the book signing, and people were buying my books, so they were just, like, elated, and they were, oh, it was awesome. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. It was so awesome. I had to just tell that story.
That's great. You stepped out there. You take a chance. Some people don't mind. You know, I switch up everything, and mm-hmm. I'll combine about 5 or 6, 7 things. Then it's the imagination part that steps in, because I always, someone said, well, she couldn't have shot no two people. I said, that's why it's called fiction.
No, right.
How could she take down 2 narcotic police? That's why it's fiction. That's unrealistic. Well, if you want real life, then just live your ordinary life. People are not reading fiction, and that's another point. Sal Stein brought that out to me. He said, don't write about ordinary people. Write about eccentric people, people that are a little over the top. Make them great. Mm-hmm. And that's, Ganama says that too, make them courageous people. Make them people that, you know, they make them very flawed, but make them have courage. Don't nobody want to read about a wimp and always whining.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you want people that are proactive. You want your hero to be proactive. It's mm-hmm. just a lot of little tips. Mm-hmm. But anyone listening who's interested in having some writing coaching, they can contact me at maxtho@aol.com. And I'm also an editor and a ghostwriter. And I'm beginning to fill up my slots for this year, 2012, so you need to get in touch with me soon. But Suzetta, give them your next book signings and your email address and where your books are available.
Okay. Well, I'm doing quite a few book clubs now because I'm getting ready to have surgery, so I'll be kind of out for a little while. But you can always check me out at my website, which is SuzettaPerkins.com, and I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. And at Twitter, I'm Author Sue. And I have a fan club also on Facebook, which is Suzetta Perkins Fan Club. And my, oh, I forgot my email, nubianque2@aol.com.
Okay, and your books are available nationwide, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And do you have a book on Black expressions right now in hardback?
No, I don't.
Okay, but they were. You've had them on hard.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. On there. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good. Did you buy you some to keep for your own collection?
Oh, of course.
Good. I mean, I love those hardbacks, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Okay. Well, Suzetta, please call me when you have your surgery, and let's stay in touch. Because sometimes we'll go a few months. All right. And continued success. I'm so proud of you.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate all your efforts on my behalf, Maxine.
All right. Well, we're getting ready to get us another book deal for 2013 because you got 2012 lined up.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks again, and I will talk to you later.
Well, thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Please return next week to the Dr. Thompson Show. See you next week. Love you all.